What are you doing to me? You've stirred up my feeling, tortured me, and now you leave me to face this night alone. He can hardly spend the night with you. Though if he wants to, let him. I'll go alone, Rakitin scoffed jeeringly. Hush, evil tongue. Grushenka cried angrily at him. You never said such words to me as he has come to say. What has he said to you so special? Asked Rakitin irritably. I can't say, I don't know. I don't know what he said to me, it went straight to my heart, he has wrung my heart. He is the first. The only one who has pitied me, that's what it is. Why did you not come before, you angel? She fell on her knees before him as though in a sudden frenzy. I've been waiting all my life for someone like you, I knew that someone like you would come and forgive me. I believed that, nasty as I am, someone would really love me, not only with a shameful love. What have I done to you? Answered Alishaw, bending over her with a tender smile, and gently taking her by the hands. I only gave you an onion, nothing but a tiny little onion, that was all. He was moved to tears himself as he said it. At that moment there was a sudden noise in the passage, someone came into the hall. Grushenka jumped up, seeming greatly alarmed. Fenya ran noisily into the room, crying out, Mistress, mistress darling, a messenger has galloped up, she cried, breathless and joyful. A carriage from Mokro for you, Timofey the driver, with three horses. They are just putting in fresh horses. A letter, here's the letter, mistress. A letter was in her hand and she waved it in the air all the while she talked. Grushenka snatched the letter from her and carried it to the candle. It was only a note, a few lines. She read it in one instant. He has sent for me, she cried, her face white and distorted, with a wan smile, he whistles. Crawl back, little dog. But only for one instant she stood as though hesitating, suddenly the blood rushed to her head and sent a glow to her cheeks. I will go, she cried, 5 years of my life. Good, bye. Good, bye, Alishaw, my fate is sealed. Go, go, leave me all of you. Don't let me see you again. Grushenka is flying to a new life. Don't you remember evil against me either, Rakitin. I may be going to my death. Ugh. I feel as though I were drunk. She suddenly left them and ran into her bedroom. Well, she has no thoughts for us now. Grumbled Rakitin. Let's go, or we may hear that feminine shriek again. I am sick of all these tears and cries. Alishaw mechanically let himself be led out. In the yard stood a covered cart. Horses were being taken out of the shafts. Men were running to and fro with a lantern. Three fresh horses were being led in at the open gate. But when Alishaw and Rakitin reached the bottom of the steps, Grushenka's bedroom window was suddenly opened and she called in a ringing voice after Alishaw, Alishaw, give my greetings to your brother Mitya and tell him not to remember evil against me, though I have brought him misery. And tell him, too, in my words, Grushenka has fallen to a scoundrel. And not to you, noble heart. And add, too, that Grushenka loved him only 1 hour, only one short hour she loved him, so let him remember that hour all his life, say, Grushenka tells you to. She ended in a voice full of sobs. The window was shut with a slam. H.M., growled Rakitin, laughing, she murders your brother Mitya and then tells him to remember it all his life. What ferocity! Alishaw made no reply, he seemed not to have heard. He walked fast beside Rakitin as though in a terrible hurry. He was lost in thought and moved mechanically. Rakitin felt a sudden twinge as though he had been touched on an open wound. He had expected something quite different by bringing Grushenka and Alishaw together. Something very different from what he had hoped for had happened. He is a Pole. That officer of hers, he began again, restraining himself, and indeed he is not an officer at all now. He served in the customs in Siberia, somewhere on the Chinese frontier, some puny little bigger of a Pole, I expect. Lost his job, they say. He's heard now that Grushenka's saved a little money, So he's turned up again, that's the explanation of the mystery. Again Alishaw seemed not to hear. Rakitin could not control himself. Well, so you've saved the sinner? He laughed spitefully. Have you turned the Magdalene into the true path? Driven out the seven devils, eh? So you see the miracles you were looking out for just now have come to pass. Hush, Rakitin, Alishaw answered with an aching heart. So you despise me now for those 25 rubles? I've sold my friend, you think. But you are not Christ, you know, and I am not Judas. Oh, Rakitin, I assure you I'd forgotten about it, cried Alishaw, you remind me of it yourself. But this was the last straw for Rakitin. Damnation take you all and each of you, he cried suddenly, why the devil did I take you up? I don't want to know you from this time forward. Go alone, there's your road. And he turned abruptly into another street, leaving Alishaw alone in the dark. Alishaw came out of the town and walked across the fields to the monastery. Chapter 4, Cana of Galilee. It was very late, according to the monastery ideas, when Alishaw returned to the hermitage. The door keeper let him in by a special entrance. It had struck 9 o'clock, the hour of rest and repose after a day of such agitation for all. Alishaw timidly opened the door and went into the elder's cell where his coffin was now standing. There was no one in the cell but Father Pacey, reading the gospel in solitude over the coffin, and the young novice Porphyry, who, exhausted by the previous night's conversation and the disturbing incidents of the day, was sleeping the deep sound sleep of youth on the floor of the other room. Though Father Pacey heard Alishaw come in, he did not even look in his direction. Alishaw turned to the right from the door to the corner, fell on his knees and began to pray. His soul was overflowing but with mingled feelings, no single sensation stood out distinctly, on the contrary, one drove out another in a slow, continual rotation. But there was a sweetness in his heart and, strange to say, Alishaw was not surprised at it. Again he saw that coffin before him, the hidden dead figure so precious to him, but the weeping and poignant grief of the morning was no longer aching in his soul. As soon as he came in, he fell down before the coffin as before a holy shrine. But joy, joy was glowing in his mind and in his heart. The one window of the cell was open, the air was fresh and cool. So the smell must have become stronger, if they opened the window, thought Alishaw. But even this thought of the smell of corruption, which had seemed to him so awful and humiliating a few hours before, no longer made him feel miserable or indignant. He began quietly praying, but he soon felt that he was praying almost mechanically. Fragments of thought floated through his soul, flashed like stars and went out again at once, to be succeeded by others. But yet there was reigning in his soul a sense of the wholeness of things, something steadfast and comforting, and he was aware of it himself. Sometimes he began praying ardently, he longed to pour out his thankfulness and love. But when he had begun to pray, he passed suddenly to something else, and sank into thought, forgetting both the prayer and what had interrupted it. He began listening to what Father Pacey was reading, but worn out with exhaustion he gradually began to doze. And the third day there was a marriage in Cana of Galilee, read Father Pacey. And the mother of Jesus was there, and both Jesus was there, and both Jesus was called, and his disciples, to the marriage. Marriage? What's that? A marriage, floated whirling through Alishaw's mind. There is happiness for her, too. She has gone to the feast. No, she has not taken the knife. That was only a tragic phrase. Well, tragic phrases should be forgiven. They must be. Tragic phrases comfort the heart. Without them, sorrow would be too heavy for men to bear. Rakitin has gone off to the back alley. As long as Rakitin broods over his wrongs, he will always go off to the back alley. But the high road. The road is wide and straight and bright as crystal, and the sun is at the end of it. Ah! What's being read? And when they wanted wine, the mother of Jesus saith unto him, they have no wine. Alishaw heard. Ah, yes, I was missing that, and I didn't want to miss it. I love that passage. It's Cana of Galilee, the first miracle. Ah, that miracle. Ah, that sweet miracle. It was not men's grief, but their joy Christ visited. He worked his first miracle to help men's gladness. He who loves men loves their gladness, too. He was always repeating that. It was one of his leading ideas. There's no living without joy, Mitya says. Yes, Mitya. Everything that is true and good is always full of forgiveness. He used to say that, too. Jesus saith unto her, Woman, what has it to do with thee or me? Mine hour not yet come. His mother saith unto the servants, Whatsoever he saith unto you, do it. Do it. Gladness, the gladness of some poor, very poor, people. Of course they were poor, since they hadn't wine enough even at a wedding. The historians write that, in those days, the people living about the Lake of Genezareth were the poorest that can possibly be imagined. And another great heart, that other great being, his mother, knew that he had come not only to make his great terrible sacrifice. She knew that his heart was open even to the simple, artless merrymaking of some obscure and unlearned people, who had warmly bidden him to their poor wedding. Mine hour is not yet come, he said, with a soft smile. He must have smiled gently to her. And, indeed, was it to make wine abundant at poor weddings he had come down to earth? And yet he went and did as she asked him. Ah, he is reading again. Jesus saith unto them, Fill the water pots with water. And they filled them up to the brim. And he saith unto them, Draw out now and bear unto the governor of the feast. And they bear it. When the ruler of the feast had tasted the water that was made wine, and knew not whence it was but the servants which drew the water knew, the governor of the feast called the bridegroom, and saith unto him, Every man at the beginning doth set forth good wine, and when men have well drunk, that which is worse, but thou hast kept the good wine until now. But what's this, what's this? Why is the room growing wider? Ah, yes. It's the marriage, the wedding. Yes, of course. Here are the guests, here are the young couple sitting, and the merry crowd and... Where is the wise governor of the feast? But who is this? Who? Again the walls are receding. Who is getting up the from the great table? What? He here, too? But he's in the coffin. But he's here, too. He has stood up, he sees me, he is coming here. God. Yes. He came up to him, he, the little, thin old man, with tiny wrinkles on his face, joyful and laughing softly. There was no coffin now, and he was in the same dress as he had worn yesterday sitting with them, when the visitors had gathered about him. His face was uncovered, his eyes were shining. How was this, then? He, too, had been called to the feast. He, too, at the marriage of Cana in Galilee. Yes, my dear, I am called, too, called and bidden, he heard a soft voice saying over him. Why have you hidden yourself here, out of sight? You come and join us too. It was his voice, the voice of Father Zosima. And it must be he, since he called him. The elder raised Alishaw by the hand and he rose from his knees. We are rejoicing, the little, thin old man went on. We are drinking the new wine. The wine of new, great gladness. Do you see how many guests? Here are the bride and bridegroom. Here is the wise governor of the feast. He is tasting the new wine. Why do you wonder at me? I gave an onion to a beggar, so I, too, am here. And many here have given only an onion each, only one little onion. What are all our deeds? And you, my gentle one, you, my kind boy, you too have known how to give a famished woman an onion today. Begin your work, dear one, begin it, gentle one. Do you see our son? Do you see him? I am afraid. I dare not look, whispered Alishaw. Do not fear him. He is terrible in his greatness, awful in his sublimity, but infinitely merciful. He has made himself like unto us from love and rejoices with us. He is changing the water into wine that the gladness of the guests may not be cut short. He is expecting new guests, he is calling new ones unceasingly forever and ever. There they are bringing new wine. Do you see they are bringing the vessels? Something glowed in Alishaw's heart, something filled it till it ached, tears of rapture rose from his soul. He stretched out his hands, uttered a cry and waked up. Again the coffin, the open window, and the soft, solemn, distinct reading of the gospel. But Alishaw did not listen to the reading. It was strange, he had fallen asleep on his knees, but now he was on his feet, and suddenly, as though thrown forward, with three firm rapid steps he went right up to the coffin. His shoulder brushed against Father Pacey without his noticing it. Father Pacey raised his eyes for an instant from his book, but looked away again at once, seeing that something strange was happening to the boy. Alishaw gazed for half a minute at the coffin, at the covered, motionless dead man that lay in the coffin, with the icon on his breast and the peaked cap with the octangular cross on his head. He had only just been hearing his voice, and that voice was still ringing in his ears. He was listening, still expecting other words, but suddenly he turned sharply and went out of the cell. He did not stop on the steps either, but went quickly down. His soul, overflowing with rapture, yearned for freedom, space, openness. The vault of heaven, full of soft, shining stars, stretched vast and fathomless above him. The Milky Way ran in two pale streams from their zenith to the horizon. The fresh, motionless, still night enfolded the earth. The white towers and golden domes of the cathedral gleamed out against the sapphire sky. The gorgeous autumn flowers, in the beds round the house, were slumbering till morning. The silence of earth seemed to melt into the silence of the heavens. The mystery of earth was one with the mystery of the stars. Alishaw stood, gazed, and suddenly threw himself down on the earth. He did not know why he embraced it. He could not have told why he longed so irresistibly to kiss it all. But he kissed it weeping, sobbing, and watering it with his tears, and vowed passionately to love it forever and ever. Water the earth with the tears of your joy and love those tears, echoed in his soul. What was he weeping over? Oh! In his rapture he was weeping even over those stars, which were shining to him from the abyss of space, and he was not ashamed of that ecstasy. There seemed to be threads from all those innumerable worlds of God, linking his soul to them, and it was trembling all over in contact with other worlds. He longed to forgive everyone and for everything, and to beg forgiveness. Oh, not for himself, but for all men, for all and for everything. And others are praying for me too, echoed again in his soul. But with every instant he felt clearly and, as it were, tangibly, that something firm and unshakable as that vault of heaven had entered into his soul. It was as though some idea had seized the sovereignty of his mind, and it was for all his life and for ever and ever. He had fallen on the earth a weak boy, but he rose up a resolute champion, and he knew and felt it suddenly at the very moment of his ecstasy. And never, never, his life long, could Alishaw forget that minute. Someone visited my soul in that hour, he used to say afterwards, with implicit faith in his words. Within 3 days he left the monastery in accordance with the words of his elder, who had bidden him sojourn in the world. Book 8 Mitya, Chapter 1 Kuzma Samsonov. But Dmitri, to whom Grushenka, flying away to a new life, had left her last greetings, bidding him remember the hour of her love forever, knew nothing of what had happened to her, and was at that moment in a condition of feverish agitation and activity. For the last 2 days he had been in such an inconceivable state of mind that he might easily have fallen ill with brain fever, as he said himself afterwards. Alishaw had not been able to find him the morning before, and Ivan had not succeeded in meeting him at the tavern on the same day. The people at his lodgings, by his orders, concealed his movements. He had spent those 2 days literally rushing in all directions, struggling with his destiny and trying to save himself, as he expressed it himself afterwards, and for some hours he even made a dash out of the town on urgent business, terrible as it was to him to lose sight of in detail, and confirmed by documentary evidence, but for the present we will only note the most essential incidents of those two terrible days immediately preceding the awful catastrophe that broke so suddenly upon him. Though Grushenka had, it is true, loved him for an hour, genuinely and sincerely, yet she tortured him sometimes cruelly and mercilessly. The worst of it was that he could never tell what she meant to do. To prevail upon her by force or kindness was also impossible, she would yield to nothing. She would only have become angry and turned away from him altogether, he knew that well already. He suspected, quite correctly, that she, too, was passing through an inward struggle, and was in a state of extraordinary indecision, that she was making up her mind to something, and unable to determine upon it. And so, not without good reason, he divined, with a sinking heart, that at moments she must simply hate him and his passion. And so, perhaps, it was, but what was distressing Grushenka he did not understand. For him the whole tormenting question lay between him and Fyodor Pavlovich. Here, we must note, by the way, one certain fact: he was firmly persuaded that Fyodor Pavlovich would offer, or perhaps had offered, Grushenka lawful wedlock, and did not for a moment believe that the old voluptuary hoped to gain his object for 3,000 rubles. Mitya had reached this conclusion from his knowledge of Grushenka and her character. That was how it was that he could believe at times that all Grushenka's uneasiness rose from not knowing which of them to choose, which was most to her advantage. Strange to say, during those days it never occurred to him to think of the approaching return of the officer, that is, of the man who had been such a fatal influence in Grushenka's life, and whose arrival she was expecting with such emotion and dread. It is true that of late Grushenka had been very silent about it. Yet he was perfectly aware of a letter she had received a month ago from her seducer, and had heard of it from her own lips. He partly knew, too, what the letter contained. In a moment of spite Grushenka had shown him that letter, but to her astonishment he attached hardly any consequence to it. It would be hard to say why this was. Perhaps, weighed down by all the hideous horror of his struggle with his own father for this woman, he was incapable of imagining any danger more terrible, at any rate for the time. He simply did not believe in a suitor who suddenly turned up again after 5 years' disappearance, still less in his speedy arrival. Moreover, in the officer's first letter which had been shown to Mitya, the possibility of his new rival's visit was very vaguely suggested. The letter was very indefinite, high, flown, and full of sentimentality. It must be noted that Grushenka had concealed from him the last lines of the letter, in which his return was alluded to more definitely. He had, besides, noticed at that moment, he remembered afterwards, a certain involuntary proud contempt for this missive from Siberia on Grushenka's face. Grushenka told him nothing of what had passed later between her and this rival, so that by degrees he had completely forgotten the officer's existence. He felt that whatever might come later, whatever turn things might take, his final conflict with Fyodor Pavlovich was close upon him, and must be decided before anything else. With a sinking heart he was expecting every moment Grushenka's decision, always believing that it would come suddenly, on the impulse of the moment. All of a sudden she would say to him, "Take me, I'm yours forever," and it would all be over. He would seize her and bear her away at once to the ends of the earth. Oh, then he would bear her away at once, as far, far away as possible, to the farthest end of Russia, if not of the earth. Then he would marry her, and settle down with her incognito, so that no one would know anything about them, there, here, or anywhere. Then, oh then, a new life would begin at once. Of this different, reformed and virtuous life, it must be virtuous, he dreamed feverishly at every moment. He thirsted for that reformation and renewal. The filthy morass, in which he had sunk of his own free will, was too revolting to him, and, like very many men in such cases, he put faith above all in change of place. If only it were not for these people, if only it were not for these circumstances, if only he could fly away from this accursed place, he would be altogether regenerated, would enter on a new path. That was what he believed in, and what he was yearning for. But all this could only be on condition of the first, the happy solution of the question. There was another possibility, a different and awful ending. Suddenly she might say to him, "Go away. I have just come to terms with Fyodor Pavlovich. I am going to marry him and don't want you," and then? But then. But Mitya did not know what would happen then. Up to the last hour he didn't know. That must be said to his credit. He had no definite intentions, had planned no crime. He was simply watching and spying in agony, while he prepared himself for the first, happy solution of his destiny. He drove away any other idea, in fact. But for that ending a quite different anxiety arose, a new, incidental, but yet fatal and insoluble difficulty presented itself. If she were to say to him, "I'm yours, take me away," how could he take her away? Where had he the means, the money to do it? It was just at this time that all sources of revenue from Fyodor Pavlovich, doles which had gone on without interruption for so many years, ceased. Grushenka had money, of course, but with regard to this Mitya suddenly evinced extraordinary pride. He wanted to carry her away and begin the new life with her himself, at his own expense, not at hers. He could not conceive of taking her money, and the very idea caused him a pang of intense repulsion. I won't enlarge on this fact or analyze it here, but confine myself to remarking that this was his attitude at the moment. All this may have arisen indirectly and unconsciously from the secret stings of his conscience for the money of Katerina Ivanovna that he had dishonestly appropriated. "I've been a scoundrel to one of them, and I shall be a scoundrel again to the other directly," was his feeling then, as he explained after, "and when Grushenka knows, she won't care for such a scoundrel." Where then was he to get the means, where was he to get the fateful money? Without it, all would be lost and nothing could be done, and only because I hadn't the money. Oh, the shame of it! To anticipate things, he did, perhaps, know where to get the money, knew, perhaps, where it lay at that moment. I will say no more of this here, as it will all be clear later. But his chief trouble, I must explain however obscurely, lay in the fact that to have that sum he knew of, to have the right to take it, he must first restore Katerina Ivanovna's 3,000. If not, I'm a common pickpocket, I'm a scoundrel, and I don't want to begin a new life as a scoundrel, Mitya decided. And so he made up his mind to move heaven and earth to return Katerina Ivanovna that 3,000, and that first of all. The final stage of this decision, so to say, had been reached only during the last hours, that is, after his last interview with Alishaw, 2 days before, on the high road, on the evening when Grushenka had insulted Katerina Ivanovna, and Mitya, after hearing Alishaw's account of it, had admitted that he was a scoundrel, and told him to tell Katerina Ivanovna so, if it could be any comfort to her. After parting from his brother on that night, he had felt in his frenzy that it would be better to murder and rob someone than fail to pay my debt to Katya. I'd rather everyone thought me a robber and a murderer, I'd rather go to Siberia than that Katya should have the right to say that I deceived her and stole her money, and used her money to run away with Grushenka and begin a new life. That I can't do. So Mitya decided, grinding his teeth, and he might well fancy at times that his brain would give way. But meanwhile he went on struggling. Strange to say, though one would have supposed there was nothing left for him but despair, for what chance had he, with nothing in the world, to raise such a sum? Yet to the very end he persisted in hoping that he would get the 3,000, that the money would somehow come to him of itself, as though it might drop from heaven. That is just how it is with people who, like Dmitri, have never had anything to do with money, except to squander what has come to them by inheritance without any effort of their own, and have no notion how money is obtained. A whirl of the most fantastic notions took possession of his brain immediately after he had parted with Alishaw 2 days before, and threw his thoughts into a tangle of confusion. This is how it was he pitched first on a perfectly wild enterprise. And perhaps to men of that kind in such circumstances the most impossible, fantastic schemes occur first, and seem most practical.